an article crossed the desk just a couple of weeks ago, and things worked out, and we were able to bring one of the gentlemen involved in here to the studios at Overnight America. And what happened was, for years and years and years, there had been these long-standing rumors of a bunch of old audio tapes up in the Northeast somewhere, and it was kind of a shadowy thing. And as a matter of fact, for our listeners on KDKA in Pittsburgh, you may have even heard these rumors from time to time, because it was around the Pennsylvania farm country that a lot of this stuff was rumored to have happened, that these old country music tapes were out there somewhere. And they gained sort of legendary status. And because of that, everybody was chasing these things. And it got to the point where a lot of people didn't even really believe the stories were true. And then all of a sudden, somebody came up with a whole bunch of audio tape. And they laid it at the feet of a gentleman who happens to be sitting right here to my right. Jay Franz is with us. And Jay, welcome to Overnight America.
Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure to have you in. Now, let's talk a little bit about the rumors themselves. How long had this been going on?
Well, this, from what I understand, has been years. It's gone on for years, and it came about by a producer named Richard Pittman out in L.A. He's originally from Pennsylvania, and he was actually traveling home one day, just driving through the countryside, and ended up just randomly getting a flat tire on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And the worker that stopped and helped him, they just became friends for years. And for years, it went by, and they never once talked about music or anything else. Well, one day he just mentioned he was a musician and he heard about these tapes. And the person who helped him change the tire, who was now his friend, actually knew of the tapes and knew of the barn and knew of where they were.
So he confirmed the existence of the tapes, first of all. And then all of a sudden he said, oh, and by the way, yes, I know where they are.
Exactly.
I can't imagine how quickly his jaw must have hit the floor when that conversation took place.
That's exactly what happened. Basically, he asked him, he said, is there any way you can get me in touch with the person who now owns the barn? And they tried for a good part of a year. And finally, they confirmed that the tapes existed. They actually got their hands on one of them to kind of prove that there was stuff on them.
Yeah.
And he made an offer. He wanted to buy the rest of the tapes. And the person who owned the barn thought he was kidding. He said, what do you want with this junk? He just thought it was junk. He didn't have any idea what the tapes were. And he said, no, these are good tapes. You know, I want to buy them. And most of the boxes are unmarked. Nobody knew what was on the tape.
Right.
So he made an offer, and the guy said no. And after about a year, he finally called him back and said, if you want them, just come get them out of my barn.
He just gave them away.
Well, they ended up paying. I don't know what they paid for them, but he gave them whatever money he offered them. But the guy just wanted him out of his barn.
Now, what we haven't said is exactly what's on the tapes, because let's talk about the origins of them in the first place. Do we know who recorded them?
Yes, Ken Alexander.
And Ken Alexander is who?
He was somebody who did live shows throughout the countryside. He would travel from venue to venue and set up the stage and actually be the front of house engineer for these shows.
So he was the guy who was standing there behind the mixing board,
correct,
making sure that everything sounded okay and that the drums and the guitars and all of that were mixed right.
Exactly. And when we say that, that's the way we look at it today.
Yeah.
But in that day, there was probably four or five channels on this console.
That's it. And now, to put that in perspective, because not everybody has seen the boards that are in a lot of bars, standard is you're going to have, what, 30, 32 tracks, something like
that? Yeah, exactly.
So he's got five to deal with, maybe.
I'm exaggerating a little. I believe he had 12.
12, okay, but still. So he's got a 12-track board sitting in front of him, and he's mixing all of these different shows, and he just decided at one point or another
he was going to start recording them.
And why wouldn't you?
Yeah, and he brought a tape machine, which was the hard part for me, is he used a consumer tape machine. So the tapes don't play on our professional tape decks. So we had to actually hunt down a consumer tape machine that would actually play these tapes.
So we're talking about now, what era?
The tapes are actually recorded from the 60s and 70s.
Okay, so a consumer, was it a reel-to-reel?
It was a reel-to-reel, yes.
So this is the kind of thing that before anybody even had 8-track decks in their house, they would have these things at home.
These reel-to-reel tapes, yes.
And how thick are the tapes?
The quarter-inch.
It's quarter-inch, okay. So,
but instead of playing 2 tracks like we would normally play from start to finish,
yeah,
this tape rewound and played the backside as well.
Oh,
so
really?
It actually split it into 4 tracks, 2 forward and 2 backwards.
I didn't even know that existed.
So
That's funny. So this stuff had been sitting in this barn. Had it ever gone anywhere in between times, or had it been there for the last 35 years?
As far as I know, the tapes were in this barn through the summer and winter for years. And there was even recordings that went back a lot further. They were actually recorded onto wire.
Wait, explain, because I have no idea what that means.
Well, they have spools of wire, which looks like fishing string, you put on a fishing pole.
Yeah.
And they have machines that would record onto this wire. And I've never seen it myself either.
Yeah.
I haven't even had a chance to get one of these to play yet. But after that article was released, we got a handful of phone calls that said, you know, hey, we have some of these machines that could play these wire recordings for you.
No kidding.
So
you haven't been able to marry that up yet?
We haven't had a chance to do it yet.
But you're on there. I bet the first thing you did was go onto eBay, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, $20.
Yeah, right.
$20 gets your wire machine these days.
Oh, man. So that's really funny. So talk about some of the names involved that are on these recordings.
Well, again, a lot of these were unmarked. And not all of them, but a lot of them were unmarked. And the first one that I picked up, I put on, it took a while to get it to play because the tape, they didn't have to be caressed too much, but they had to be caressed a little bit to get them to play. And once we got them to play, the first one I put on was Roy Acuff.
Okay.
And it amazed me that there was more talking and jokes and skits throughout his show than there was actually music. So it was just a whole different experience because I wasn't around during his shows.
Right.
And it was just a whole learning curve for me. And then as we went through, there was Hank Williams Jr. There was Porter Wagner with Dolly Parton playing in his shows.
When they're all kids.
Right. Exactly. And Loretta Lynn and Crystal Gayle came up on stage and played the night before she recorded her very first album.
Oh, now that's funny.
And my favorite of the tapes so far is the one that is completely out of character of the rest of them was Jerry Lee Lewis.
Out of character how?
Out of character because everybody was very serious and had very structured shows. And he came up and he definitely didn't have a structured show. He showed up late. It was a pretty good indication that he'd been drinking. He'd forget lyrics. And, I mean, Great Balls of Fire,
Jerry
the most
Lee
popular
Lewis
song.
Drinking? Yes. Come on.
I know. It's hard to believe, but it's true.
Yeah. So, it's got to be, when you're listening to the banter that goes on stage, it's got to be something not only in terms of having the music, but with a lot of the musical recordings, even the live recordings that came out of that era in country music, there was no banter. All they would do is they would take the song, start the track, and end with applause, and then start with applause and go into the next track. That's got to be quite a history of country music, just listening to these people talk on stage.
You wouldn't even begin to believe it. I mean, there is definitely more talking than music on most of these shows, mm-hmm. especially the older ones. The jokes they tell, I mean, it's just funny. And the jokes range from anything from clean to dirty jokes.
That's also funny, yeah, because you wouldn't think. I want to hear Loretta Lynn tell a dirty joke. I don't think that probably ever happened, though. But with the music itself, talk about your own history. What do you normally gravitate towards?
Well, I've lived the past 10 years in Nashville, so I've worked and listened to a lot of country music.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in Boston, and I listened to a lot of rock music.
So you've got a little bit of background in everything.
Yeah, a little bit.
And so how did you end up having these tapes show up on your door?
Well, the producer, Richard, out in L.A., I've actually worked with him. I met him in Nashville almost the day that I moved to Nashville.
Okay.
So I've known him for the 10 years that I was in Nashville, and now I'm back in Boston. And I've worked on a lot of his projects for him. I met him, we got along, and everything worked out really well. Personalities clicked. He hires me to work on all of the projects he does, and this one came along, and he said, "You're never going to guess what I have." I said, "What's that?" He goes, "I bought something today."
Yeah.
I'm like, "Well, what'd you buy?" He's like, "A whole lot of analog tape." And my first response was, "Well, why?"
Yeah.
And
right, because nobody uses it anymore.
Well, he told me, he goes, "I don't know what's on it, but I'm going to send it to you. And if you could transfer it for me and clean it up and master it for me." I'm like, "Sure." So he sent it to me. And like I said, the first one was Ray Cuff. And I was like, "Okay." And then I think the next one was Hank Williams Jr.
I'm yeah.
like, "Okay, something's different here." So we just went through all these tapes.
We're going to talk about how much he sent you and what you've had to do with it to do the restoration process and all of that. We'll do some of that coming up, and you've been kind enough to bring us some of your work as well. So we'll hear what you've been doing and in some of these restorations. And again, this is music that has not been heard by human ears outside the recording studio in a great number of decades. So stick with us. Overnight America continues. It is a Friday morning here on the program. John Grayson with you, and there is more to come.
Which is the best sports city in America? Discuss. This is Overnight America with John Grayson.
All right, we'll get to that in due time. Here's a song about growing up in the city and liking things that are real country.
John Grayson here with you, joined by Jay Franz, who's been doing a lot of the restoration work on these country music tapes that have been lost now for a good long time, decades and decades. And what are we listening to here?
That's John Hartford. It's working in tall buildings.
And do we have any idea, again, era, when this was recorded?
This one was late 60s, like 68.
And it's got to be fun because, as you mentioned, a lot of these are marked. A lot of the tape boxes that you got are completely unmarked, and you have, no idea what's on them until you put them on the recorder and listen to them.
Exactly, and then we have to do an awful lot of research. Luckily, I had two assistants who helped me out. One of them's here with me tonight, Ben. And I tell you, it's amazing the amount of work that we went through and actually researched to find out where the show was, what guest musicians sat in on that show that night.
How do you do that? Where do you start?
I wouldn't even begin to tell you.
You just go.
You just jump in.
A lot of phone calls and a lot of research
calls,
on the net.
Internet, yeah. The internet became our friend.
And have you gotten, I mean, I'm sure there are, even to this point, there are shows that you have on tape that you don't know exactly where or when.
Exactly. Or something might be marked as, such and such high school. And it's like, okay. And then by doing a little bit of research, you find out they used to have shows at these high schools.
Yeah.
But a lot of times we'll get some information, maybe a date or maybe a venue. Once you get a little bit, you have to try and find more.
Now that sounds great.
That was
an outstanding recording. It's nice and clean. And I mean, I guess it's testament not only to your talents, but also to the guy who did the recordings in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how good the people think there was a lot wrong with these tapes to begin with. And it wasn't, there's nothing wrong with them. They were just old and staticky, and some of the tape was crinkled. We had to kind of iron it out a little bit and get it to play a little bit smoother. But it just took a little bit of work, mostly time.
Yeah, right. It's just a very time-consuming process. Now, is there a lot of digital restoration that goes into this as well? Once you get it recorded onto a digital format, do you play with it much?
We tried to keep everything as authentic as possible, but there's a lot of, just noise reduction.
Okay. Yeah, so you get a little bit of that tape hiss going, so you got to remove some of that. Now, with the old version of that, I mean, what most of us were familiar with was the stuff that was on the car stereo, the old Dolby B system.
There you go.
And that noise reduction also had the tendency to take out a lot of the high end that was supposed to be there.
That's correct.
Take out the hi-hats on the drums and some other things that were supposed to be there. How much better have we gotten?
A lot better. This software that I'm working with these days is leaps and bounds above that. But it still, if you're not careful, can do the same thing. I mean, if you tell the software to get rid of a frequency that is known to be characteristic of the tape hiss, that same frequency falls in instruments, like you said, the hi-hat and other cymbals or higher frequencies. So you have to just be very careful.
Yeah, and even some voices can get taken down a little bit in some of the S's. And they had stuff that, even going back into the 60s and 70s, would take out, they called it a de-esser, right?
Yeah.
That would take out that...
sibilance.
Yeah, right, exactly. A lot of folks will know this if you've recorded things on your own tape recorder. Anytime you say an S, it sounds 400 times louder than anything else you say. And so they were able to do that. Was any of that available, I mean, when these recordings were made?
Not originally, no. Or at least not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. So it was pretty much just a dry recording of
exactly.
Whatever was there. And it's got to be so much fun to deal with that stuff and to go back again, not only from a musical standpoint, but a historical standpoint, to realize what you're dealing with.
Exactly.
How much material is there?
Now, this is going to sound funny, but it took 2 pickup trucks to remove these tapes. There has to be at least 1,000 tapes.
Well, and since the pickup truck is the official measurement, the official unit of measurement in country music,
exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. So 2 pickup trucks, the whole bed full of tapes.
Full of tapes, yeah.
And how far into the project are you?
I've received 50 tapes.
So.
And we've been working on it for, well, the better part of this past year.
So do you have anything that you have planned for the rest of your life? Because it sounds like you're going to be busy for a while.
It's going to be busy for a little bit, yeah.
Now, what's eventually going to happen to all of this stuff?
From what I understand, they're looking to auction the tapes off as a whole. But what they're doing is they're taking the tapes that people are going to be interested in, like the Loretta Lynn or the, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, and we're transferring them, we're cleaning them, and we're mastering them. So whoever purchases them will have the original tape, but they'll also have a master that they can play or distribute or do anything they want with it without having to keep going back to the tape or without having to pay any extra to have that done again.
Because with magnetic tape, anytime you play it, you're going to lose a little bit of what's on there.
Exactly. And a lot of this tape is pretty fragile.
Yeah.
So we don't want to take the chance of, you know, it snapping.
Would you be surprised, and obviously, I mean, you don't know what the eventual disposition of all of this is going to be, but would you be surprised to see the physical entity, the actual tapes, end up in a museum somewhere?
Well, that's part of the talk. Richard is really big on the community and giving back, and he does that with everything. He's not, I know it's going to seem odd, but he's not concerned about money. And when he does these projects, you know, they're going to sell them. There's going to be a profit somewhere, I'm sure. But one of the things he is going to do is give back to museums. He wants to save a handful of the tapes to do the Country Music Museum. I talked to a museum on the way here for Little Jimmy Dickens.
Yeah.
In the Hall of Fame, I guess it is, in West Virginia. They want one of the tapes. So, you know, eventually I'm sure we'll see this stuff everywhere.
And Little Jimmy Dixon is one of the voices that we're going to hear in just a little while as well. We've got another John Hartford cut. And Jay Franz, again, is with us, who is doing the remastering and the engineering work on cleaning these tapes up and getting them ready. So, and before we head, well, I'll tell you what, I'll save that for just a second because we do want to get back to the music. What more do we have from John Hartford?
This is good old electric washing machine.
All right, we'll use this into the break. There is more Overnight America coming. John Grayson here with you. It is a Friday morning on the program.
Well, I sure do miss that good old electric washing machine. Oh, one that we ain't got round here no more. And I sure do miss that big round tub and them stomping, swinging sound. Miss them groovy buttons on the floor.
New and just sits there in the corner of the basement on Monday morning, all of its white porcelain glory going. But the old one went.
Cry when I see that brand new automatic washing machine. Cause I'm sentimental for the old machine still, yeah. Cause
the old one really looks like.
Six past the hour. Overnight America, John Grayson here with you. Joined in studio by recording engineer Jay Franz. And you got a website for your business as well, yes?
Yes, sir.
Where do we find you on the net?
Well, there's two of them, jfranzy.com and franzymusic.com.
I've been saying Franz all night and it's Franzy.
Yeah,
you didn't even correct
Either
me.
Either way, I'm good like that.
Very good. And
I won't tell you what my mother calls me.
Yeah, probably better not to since we could both get fined. So, and again, we've been talking about restoring all of these country tapes that were discovered. And when was the discovery actually made? When did they get pulled out of that barn?
I received them last summer. And I got them probably 2 weeks after he received them.
After they were found. So it's we've only known of the existence of these for a little over a year.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, we played a little bit of the music from John Hartford, and we mentioned Hank Williams Jr., and he's, obviously we don't know exactly how much of the tapes are Hank Jr. because we're still digging through them, but a lot of it is, and we've got some to play, yeah?
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit of what Hank had for us.
And now comes the part of the show that I really enjoy. Tonight we have with us Daddy's Hank Williams' original drifting band, the Drifting Cowboys. And this is, they deserve a hand. Thank you. This is the first time that they've worked in 15 years since Daddy's death. And we're going to try to go back and retrace those famous historical years of 1949 and 1950, 51, and his last and greatest year of 1952.
I got a feeling called the blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Sittin' high, oh Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I thought I would cry. You know she'd do me and do you. She's got that kind of lovin'. Oh, I love to hear when she called me screaming, Daddy, such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over. I've lost my heart, it seems. Well, I'm grown so used to you. Somehow, I ain't nobody sugar daddy now, and I'm lonesome. I got the looks sick blue.
39 past the hour. That's Hank Williams Jr. a long, long time ago, and it's a long way from that to Are You Ready for Some Football, isn't it? Doesn't sound anything like him. He sounds a lot more like
more
his dad,
like his
back,
dad
in,
right?
Back in those days, and of course, playing with his dad's band as well. I didn't even know he had ever done that.
No.
So, again, you know, it's country music history just coming out all over the place. And what I was going to ask you just before we broke for the bottom of the hour is about rights and everything now. I mean, digital rights management is such a huge deal on the net, and everybody's talking about the RIAA and their, you know, piece of the music and the, and you know, while your boss, I mean, not your boss, but the guy who gave you the tapes,
sure,
he may not be as interested in money from these as everybody else would be, but
somebody's gonna be interested.
So who owns the rights to this stuff?
That's unknown to me.
Who knows, right? Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see how that all pans out, because you know, you've got artist fees and all of that, so if anybody decides that they want to make money with these things,
somebody's gonna eventually have to get all the licensing to release it and sell it.
Wow. I wouldn't even want to. How many lawyers can you fit into one room?
Into a room, right. I mean, this is why that they're probably going to talk about selling them as a collection, making a one-time sale, and, you know, because eventually somebody, in order to release these and sell them to the public, somebody's going to have to license it.
I'm surprised we haven't already gotten a cease and desist from Hank Williams just from that, you know, just from playing that on the air. But it really is cool that we're able to, you know, after all this time, to play this stuff for the folks who, you know, who are listening in all over the country on Overnight America tonight. But do you have any idea, because of all of that, if and when things like this will ever be released to the public?
I know I'm heading to Nashville next week, and one of the meetings I have down there is to talk about things like that.
Okay.
To talk about who might want to buy some of the tapes or release some of the tapes, or, you know, so we'll see.
Tell some stories about what happened when you started to put these tapes on the reels. I mean, was there a wow moment for you? I guess there's probably been 100 of them.
There's been a few of them.
Listen to the tapes going, it's what? Talk about it.
My favorite wow moment is the Jerry Lee Lewis tape.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing to me when I first came across a box marked Jerry Lee Lewis. And then when I put it on there, like I said, it was different from the rest of them because he's just completely, you know, out of the ordinary. You don't know what he's going to do. He's so unpredictable.
Yeah.
And he's up on stage and singing Great Balls of Fire and, you know, off in his own world and humming different lyrics or whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, and you can almost see him. I mean, when you're listening to, because I've heard some live tapes of him before, obviously nothing like this, but you really can. You can see him just going crazy and that hair flying all over the place and all of that stuff while you're just listening.
And just acting so unpredictable, like he doesn't care what anybody thinks.
Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about your own, you know, musical tastes, and you know, rock and country have been part of it over the years, but were you fans of a lot of the people, or a fan of a lot of the people that you found on these tapes?
A lot of them I was, but a lot of them I didn't know, like Roy Acuff. I've never listened to Roy Acuff.
Yeah.
And for me to come across that tape, it opened up a whole different world for me. You know, listening to the skits, listening to him talk, getting a feel for his personality, that's what made it different rather than just driving through the streets of Nashville and seeing his name on everything.
Yeah.
You know, to actually hear him talk and to actually hear some jokes and just get a feel for him himself.
You know what surprises me a little bit is that there's a good friend of the program, and I love dropping names, so it's a guy whose name happens to be on this mic stand right here, Bob Heil, who is a longtime sound engineer and a guy who worked with The Who and built that sequencer that they did all of the keyboard stuff with and came up with the talk box and all of that stuff. And, you know, he talked about building a lot of the stuff in the late 60s that is common use now. I mean, these huge speakers, because concerts like that used to be tiny little PAs, and that's really all you got.
Right.
And so it's interesting to me to hear that this stuff that came out of that era sounds as clean and as good as it did, because in these gymnasiums and high schools and things like that, I'm surprised that the recording equipment and the sound equipment was good enough to get something that sounded like that.
Well, I mean, it did. Everything sounded great. Everything sounded so much better than we could have ever expected.
Yeah.
But there was still a lot of work that went into cleaning them. And if, you know, I wish I was able to play you a before and after.
How much of the cleaning process is chemical?
There was none of that.
None. Really? So you don't, I mean, not even like alcohol?
Well, we used alcohol to clean the recording equipment.
Okay.
Or the playback of the tape machine.
Yeah.
And that had to be done extremely frequently because the tape would just shed nonstop.
And it's shedding the
particles that make up the tape.
Which is not a good thing to have happen, because you lose sound along with that when that goes. So what do you do to the actual physical tape to clean it up?
The tape itself, there's really not much we can do. I mean, I suppose if it was to a point where we would have to bake it to kind of make the particles stick to themselves a little bit better. But we didn't have to do that. Everything played. It's just the tape machines, just dust and, you know, everything just had to be cleaned, you know, in between every play.
Yeah.
You know.
And just keep at it.
We had a lot of Q-tips and alcohol.
All right. Well, Jay, hang on for us for just a second. We'll do some more talking and play some more music coming up, and we do have some of that Jerry Lee Lewis to play. And some more Hank Jr., I believe, that will play for you right here going into the break. And again, there is more Overnight America coming up. Jay Franzi is with us, who's cleaning up all of these tapes that were lost for decades and finally found in a barn in Pennsylvania, and a lot of country music history, including this.
Sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell you.
And again, not senior, but junior singing this one. Hank Williams Jr. There is more to come. Overnight America continues on this Friday morning.
You're listening to Overnight America with John Grayson.
one by one. They're turning out the lights. I've been beating that old jukebox. I just wanna hold you tight. I guess it's for the best. I just put in my last dime. Heard you whisper, we'll meet again. Another place, another time.
Coming up on 50 past the hour, Overnight America continues. John Grayson here with you. Jay Frenzy with us, doing the restoration work on all of these lost country tapes that, you know, I hate the fact that we're having to tease people with this because I know there's a bunch of people listening going, oh, come on, I would buy that right now if I could. But you can't yet, right?
And it's too bad, isn't it?
Yeah, and we got a little Jerry Lee Lewis singing right here, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah, and again, most of the stuff that we're used to hearing from Jerry Lee doesn't sound much like that. It's a little more rockabilly.
Definitely.
Yeah, so to hear him go with that kind of old-school style, another one of those sort of wow moments. So talk about some more and some things that that you discovered while you were going through these tapes.
Well, the other one to me was Crystal Gayle sitting in with her sister the night before she recorded her very first album.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, hearing her like that and, you know, almost nervous-like on stage, but to come up there before ever recording an album and just sounding amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and were there people that that didn't sound so good? I mean, at least vocally?
No, you know, actually, I think everybody sounded great. I've made comments several times that I just can't believe the quality of musicianship and the artists themselves, just how good everything was.
Yeah.
You know, the musicians just played. You don't hear mistakes. There's no flaws. The singers just get up there, and not only were they able to sing, but they're able to, you know, communicate with the audience and the banter was just amazing. Everything was great.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the musicianship. I mean, all of the bands are nice and tight.
Oh, yeah.
And, I have to wonder, because I don't know from country music when they were doing all of this, did they have touring bands that would just go with and they would play whatever you wanted to sing?
Well, that's what these bands were doing.
Okay.
You know, every single artist on the tapes had their own backup band.
Okay.
So
they just had the guys that would tour with them.
Exactly.
That's very cool. So talk about a little more of the process about, you know, when you go through. We talked about taking some of the noise out of the tapes, but you mentioned baking, and that's something that you haven't had to do. How does that process work? Because we had talked to Warren Zevon's son, Jordan, about going back and finding a vault full of tapes, and he said there was stuff that they had to bake. I'm assuming that doesn't mean $3.50 for an hour and a half.
No, but it's something similar. You're just putting tapes in an oven to warm them up to tighten up the particles, just to make everything stick together so that it's not falling apart when you play it, and that the tape doesn't stick to itself.
Yeah, and because a lot of times I know what happened. I mean, anybody who had a cassette deck in their car knows about this, especially with the longer tapes. I mean, the tape was thinner. There would be bleed through from one,
sure,
from
one
having
side
the tape
to the other
wrapped
side
around itself. Yeah. Yeah. Did you have any of that happen to you?
Very, very little. There was some of it.
Can you do anything about that when that happens?
No, not really. And luckily, I mean, it's so little and so faint that it's just a little bit of a ghost to it. But what it is with these tapes is it didn't just play from one direction, left to right. It actually played on both sides.
Yeah.
So some of that would bleed through on the ends of the tape.
So you'd get it backwards.
Yeah.
So you'd start on the other side of the tape.
And it's funny, too, because the tape will be playing along, and you'll be listening to probably the song you're most excited about on this tape, and then all of a sudden the tape will just fall right off the reel.
Wow.
And then you flip it, you know, you restring it and play the other side, and there it is halfway through the song.
Yeah.
So some of these you lose a song, but some of them you're lucky enough that they play. Most of these shows were played twice in a night. So they'll play their first set, and then they'll play the same exact set for another group of people just an hour or so later.
Yeah, because they clear out the bar and
exactly.
Then bring new people in. So how long was a set usually?
These tapes were about 2 hours long and usually had two sets on them.
Okay, so you get about an hour a set. So that's a pretty decent show.
Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff. And I tell you what, you talk about a song to be excited about. We're going to go out with one of those. We played a little Jerry Lee just a minute ago. We're going to play a little bit more. And Jay Franzi, fascinating stuff, man. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, no problem. Anytime.
Giving us a skinny on this, and we'll keep in touch with you and let us know. Keep us posted about what gets released and when and all of that stuff so that we can tell the folks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, all right. We'll go out with a little more Jerry Lee Lewis, and that last song may not be one you're used to him singing, but this one probably is.
Yeah! Check my nerves and you rattle my brain. Give my love and drive the stud and sing. Hug my wheel. What a thrill. Good and great. With all the fire. I landed love on a phone bun. I'm a long fool now, honey. 10 miles, love is fine. Good and great. With all the fire. Baby. Feels good. Hold me, mama. I've been loving my loving like a lover should. Good man. Oh, kind. Hell in this world that you might have.
Not everyone has a 9-to-5 job. This is Overnight America with John Grayson.